been very nice visiting the eye so far. I've had some nice discussions with people. I hope to have some more later during the week, obviously, for Friday. So I'll be talking about a proposal for generating and detecting Ginsburg or Horn filing estates in circuit 3D. This is work that's recently published a couple months ago in the Journal of Physics. And there's quite a long list of people who are involved in this work, including Jay Gambetta, who's here. But a bunch of other people who, basically, when you see what I've got to say, the basic idea is quite simple. But quite a large number of people touched it along the way because contributing a little bit and then getting stuck and moving on to other things. And it took several years before we sort of tied it all together into a nice story to write the paper. So the outline of this is, well, I expect everybody here knows a little bit about
superconducting qubits, but I'll just put this in sort of experimental context, tell you the kind of parameters of the system that we're dealing with, so I can lead on to that, why I think that preparation by measurement, and this particularly this nonlinear filtering, which I'll describe in the second part, are particularly appropriate ways of generating time states like GHC states for circuit QED in particular. And then and I'll show that actually using these tools, generating GHC states with quite decent fidelity is definitely possible with the parameters that are experimentally available today. And then the third part of the talk will be how to measure the states we've produced in this way and convince ourselves or convince other people that we've actually generated entangled states. And that turns out to be quite a bit harder. That's a bit more open-ended. I'd like to talk to people here about some of these things if people have ideas. But basically, we've come up with an idea we think is quite clever, which gives us a very simplified version of detector tomography for the particular detection scheme we're using. And of course, generating GHC states, people think about Bell tests, and I'll try and put this in context with how this all relates to doing a Bell test. So first of all, to start off with just the experimental context, I'll just go quickly through this. It's not new work. The basic idea is we use superconducting circuits. We have circuit elements which are non-dissipating, so no resistors, so capacitors, inductors, and nonlinear inductors, aka Josephson elements. And we can put these together in various topologies. The three main ones are the pair box, the flux qubits, and the phase qubits, which are associated with different experimental groups. There's a nice review of these topologies by Clark and Wilhelm last year. The version of the circuit that we use at Yale is this one, the charge qubit, the pair box. And in order to do interesting things with these, we use an analogy to cavity QED. So cavity QED is what you do when you take real atoms and you put them in a 3D Fabry-Perot cavity. So it's something like this. Very high finesse cavity. And you have some coupling between the atomic states and the light field, the electromagnetic field. You can do this either with alkali or Rydberg atoms, which gives you either optical or microwave cavities. And when you write down the Hamiltonian for the system, it's the James Cummings Hamiltonian. You have the term describing the electromagnetic field, the term describing your two-level atom, and the coupling term G. And the important thing is this sort of dimensionless ratio G over omega, which tells you how strongly are you coupled relative to the frequency. And typically for real cavity QED with real atoms, this is kind of in the order of 10 to the minus 6. When you do this with the superconducting so-called atoms, superconducting qubits, you use a 1D transmission line resonator to act like your Fabry-Perot, and your atoms are now these superconducting qubits. We actually use a variation on the standard charge qubit, which is called trans-1. That's not really important for this talk, but they sit here in the middle in at the ends of this transmission line resonator. And you can't see them here, but there's capacitors at the end of this line, which basically act as the mirrors for the resonator. And so analogous to the atoms, we have qubits, analogous to these 3D cavities, we have transmission line resonators. And the interesting thing is this figure of merit, this G over omega, the coupling strength is much, much larger. And that's really just due to the quasi one-dimensional nature of this system. you can relate this number to the fine structure constant. So we can easily reach a strong coupling regime. I'll describe that in a minute. Nice thing is that the atom is spatially fixed. We don't have to worry about the atom moving around, being pushed around by the light field and so on. So we can drive the increase the drive strength over a huge range without any problems. And as I said, described by the James Cummings Hamiltonian. So we have this strong coupling between the qubit and the resonator. In the absence of that coupling, if we tune the qubit frequency, sorry, the cavity frequency and the qubit frequency to be the same, we would have a degeneracy between there being one excitation in the cavity versus one excitation in the qubit. But this coupling causes a Lipschitz degeneracy and causes a splitting called the vacuum-Rabi splitting. And basically, the strong coupling regime is when that splitting is large compared to all the dissipation processes. And so here we have the line width is very small, but separate this vacuum-Rabi splitting is very large. We have something like 100 line widths of strong coupling. So we're very much in that regime. And so we can think about doing things like driving this very strongly. And not only do you have the one excitation manifold, you also have the two excitation manifold and a whole ladder of these states. And if you drive hard enough, you can do Morse-Poisson transitions up this ladder. And sure enough, you see these in the experimental phase. And if we actually would say take just a slice for a particular driving strength, so the y-axis is driving strength, the x-axis is frequency, and the color axis is transmission, take a slice through along here. The red is the theory, the data, and the black is the theory, and you see it agrees extremely well. We have an excellent theoretical description of this system, and this gives us a very nice way to extract all the parameters of the system. And one thing in particular that is the real, for the purpose of this talk, is the important thing, is that we can extract basically an effective temperature of the system, which tells us how well are we preparing the ground state. And we can put a lower bound on that as being that we're preparing the ground state with greater than 99.7% fidelity. Actually, we think we're doing quite a lot better than this, but this is just a little bit. So, okay, we can prepare a state very nicely. We can also do one cubic rotations, which they do with these extremely carefully shaped microwave pulses. There's a lot of experimental know-how that goes into doing these, and Jane and people have come up with some clever schemes for optimizing these pulses. But the upshot of this is that we can do this is a result from randomized benchmarking, and basically we can see that per rotation we have an error per gate of about 1%. I think actually now it's even
better. Is the pulse slightly asymmetric, or is that an illusion?
I believe it's slightly asymmetric. There's some tricky stuff that goes on into optimizing this.
So it's a rather complicated shape.
Yeah, I mean they can actually this is 3 nanoseconds standard deviation gap Gaussian, roughly, but they can control this on the 1 nanosecond time scale. So this is, I guess, 20 nanoseconds, and they can really shape it on the 1 nanosecond.
I was struck by how similar it is to the Dairy Queen symbol, which actually does have a little asymmetry.
I'm not sure that this particular one is supposed to have asymmetry, but certainly we've used pulses for this. We can do very good 1-qubit rotations. Next thing we'd like to do is do things which involve 2-qubits, 2-qubit gates, and there are different ways that you could imagine to couple 2 or more superconducting qubits to each other. You could use a capacitor, as we've done at NEC. And at UCSB, you could use an inductor, has been done at Delft, or you could use a tunable element, for example, a squib, which has been done at Berkeley, FSC, and Chalmers. But the way we will do it is we'll actually just put 2 of these qubits in the same superconducting cavity. And because they both couple to the cavity, they talk to each other. So here's the cartoon. You have 2 qubits, 1 at each end of this cavity. And they sort of, by exchanging virtual photons through the cavity, they sort of switch. And this is a nice setup, because you basically have two ports to do everything. You put in microwave tones at one end, and you measure what comes out the other end, and you can use this for rotations and measurements of both. So that's the cartoon. This is what a real sample looks like. It's very similar. You have cavity, input, what side, output side, qubits at each end. And the new thing that's sort of the new piece of technology that's new as of this year in this setup is what these flux bias lines, which are these extra connections here, which allow you to change the frequency of the two qubits individually on a fast time scale. And that turns out to be extremely useful. And I won't go into a lot of details, but the point
why is it this intricate shape to the cavity?
That's just so you can compress 7 millimeters of cavity, which is set by the half, it needs to be a halfway cavity, onto a 7 millimeter chip, which is how big their chips are.
Oh, I see. So they get them from some manufacturer that says I can only make 7 millimeters?
No, I think they actually slice them up into 7 millimeter chips themselves, but they have, you know, nicely machined boxes that they put them into that are set up to have a 7 millimeter chip.
Okay.
And that's, I guess, set by the constraints of this needs to all fit inside a dilution refrigerator and it can only be so large. So here's just an example of two qubits interacting with each other. We're using these flux bias lines to tune one of the qubits and keep the other one at the same frequency. And we have the cavity down here, and we see, okay, if we tune this qubit all the way down to the cavity, there's an avoided crossing cavity, that's vacuum wrapping splitting that I was talking about. If you tune the one qubit just to the same frequency as the other qubit, we have an avoided crossing here. This is the swap interaction that was studied in the Nature paper in 2007. In the recent work, it's not shown on this diagram. It's a little complicated to explain. I have some extra slides if people are interested at the end, they can ask. We actually do a different kind of interaction, a sort of a ZZ interaction, which happens before you actually reach this place where the qubits cross. But anyway, you can see from this picture that the qubits do interact via the cavity, which is the important thing. Okay, so we can operate in the dispersive regime, which means that the qubits are far detuned from the cavity. And so we take the James Cummings Hamiltonian gets generalized to the Tavis Cummings Hamiltonian, which is just the James Cummings Hamiltonian with more than one qubit. So they each have a qubit term and each have a coupling term. And in the dispersive regime, we can simplify this instead of having annihilation times creation plus creation times annihilation. We can turn this into a dispersive coupling, which is a dagger a times sigma z. And what this basically means is that you can either think of this as a shift of the cavity frequency dependent on the state of the qubits, or a shift of the qubit frequency dependent on the state of the cavity. And that turns out to be useful because you can use that for readout. So this is a cartoon. We have the frequency of the cavity, and depending on what the state of the two qubits is, we get different peaks. The cavity transmission peak will get shifted around by being pushed around by the states of the qubits. So we have four separate peaks. The fact that these peaks are well separated means we're in a strong dispersive regime, which is possible to reach with superconducting qubits. It's quite hard to reach with real atoms. And so you can sort of think about this as a state-dependent refractive index material being inserted into an optical cavity, if you like. So it's greater than one epsilon permittivity if the qubit's in the down state, and greater than less than one if it's in the up state. So it's just cavity frequency. Interesting thing is that the cavity, the shift of the cavity frequency is linear in the qubit state, but that means that the transmitted amplitude is nonlinear. So you have to distinguish between whether you're talking about the frequency or the transmitted amplitude. But in general, you get some, if these peaks are not completely separated, you get some general nonlinear function of the two spins for your transmitted amplitude. And you can actually test this experimentally. It works very well. If you're just rotating the red qubit, you get some decaying oscillations, and you take the Fourier transform, you get a single peak. If you rotate the blue qubit, you get another decaying oscillations, you get a second peak. And if you rotate them both at once, you get the two peaks here. But you also, from this cross term, you also get side bands. You get these additional peaks that work there in this term. So this shows that this measurement model works very well. And I won't go any talk about any further about this, but next week at IPC, Jerry Chow, one of the experimental colleagues, will be talking about exactly this stuff. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, you should check that out. And so this has all been put together, and using all these ingredients, yeah.
Do you have a reader for the event, or welcome readers?
This is all ensemble average. So single shot readout fidelity is very poor. The best we've come up with is around 50% or worse. And that's for a sample that's really optimized to have the best readout fidelity single shot. This is all ensemble average, and so, I mean, we characterized it and the model works very well, but it's not a single shot. I'll come back to that. So this is all, you can put all this together and you can actually run algorithms. This is just an example from the paper a couple months ago. This is the Grover algorithm, and you can actually do the different steps of the Grover algorithm and take slices at different places and just measure the density matrix. And this is, I'm plotting the real part of the two-qubit density matrix. And you see that this looks very nice. And this is measurement, not theory. Sure, and the final result is that there's 80% algorithm fidelity, which is quite good. Okay, so that's kind of the experimental context that all this work is falling in. We have semi-QED building blocks, which give us, we use a strong coupling to a cavity bus. I didn't really talk about this, but the cavity bus basically shields the qubits from the electromagnetic continuum. They only see noise that is allowed in by the bus, by the cavity, which has to be within a line with the cavity frequencies. That's great. We have better than 99% state preparation. We have extremely good one qubit gates. We have pretty good two qubit gates, but they're not as good. And we have a usable joint readout, but it's generally an ensemble average readout. And so, using these building blocks, what can we do that's interesting? And so I'll talk about in my next part, preparation by measurements. And in particular, the state I want to prepare by measurements is the GHC state, which, just to remind everybody, I'm sure you all know, is the state of, you know, for n qubits, you have n all down, superposed with n qubits all up. It's a maximally entangled state. Today, just for clarity, I'll mostly just talk about the three qubit state. It gets kind of complicated to generalize to n qubits, although it's totally doable. And GHC states are interesting because they can be used as a resource for quantum information in various ways. Also useful for doing Bell tests. We can certainly prepare those by using gates, but I'm going to talk about preparing by measurement. And so what exactly, in general, is preparation by measurement? We initialize our system in the ground state. As I said, we can do that very well. We do some one-qubit rotations. Again, we can do those very well. And that puts us into some product state. So we have, you know, some mixture of the first qubit is in some superposition of up and down, it's phase, the second qubit is in some superposition up and down, and so on. And then we perform a projective measurement that is unable to distinguish a certain subset of these states. So it has some, you know, for a given outcome, it has some manifold that it can't distinguish. And if we post-select for that result that's interesting to us, we basically project this state onto an interesting state program. So this will only succeed probabilistically. We might not get the result we want. But if we select for the interesting state, then hopefully we can do a preparation. So certainly this is not a new idea. Preparation by measurements in general has been around for a long time. It's quite recently been applied specifically to circuit QED for the purposes of making two-qubit Bell states by Chantal Hutchison and Jay Ometa and some other people. And they showed that you can use this to make nice two-qubit Bell states. We basically stole their technology and generalized it to the three-qubit case. For our recent work. We weren't the only people to do so. Helmer from Arkart basically wrote a very similar paper, but with a slightly different focus. So before I was talking about the regime of strong dispersive readouts, where these peaks, the cavity peaks were well separated. So what I'm plotting here is the two quadratures, if you're doing a homodyne measurement of the cavity, dependent on the different qubit states. And it turns out that in order to apply this technology that Hutchison et al. Developed, it's easier to work in the opposite limits where these peaks are not well separated and they overlap strongly. And so if you look at the eye quadrature, you're not going to see much difference between the transmission in that quadrature, depending on the different states of the qubits. However, if you look at the Q quadrature, you see a difference. And so basically, if you have your dispersive coupling term, which has different chi's for the different qubits, telling you how much the cavity frequency is shifted depending on the qubit state, and you measure this Q, you get to effectively measure the operator A being the sum of these chi's times the qubit state. So if you stick you stick in a tone at this frequency here, you'll get different transmitted amplitudes depending on the different states of the qubit. And so you'll, depending on which state your qubit is in, you'll get some. You know, if the qubits are all up, you'll get this peak. If the qubits are in a different state, you'll get these other peaks. The width of these peaks it's not delta function like, it's set by this noise. So depending on how long you integrate for, is how narrow you can make these peaks, how distinguishable these states are from each other. And the basic idea for applying this to preparation by measurements of the GHD states is if we choose a particular ratio for these dispersive chi's being 1:1:2, then down, down, up, and up, up, down become indistinguishable. The cavity shift for both of those is the same. And so if we measure and we find that the cavity frequency the transmitted amplitude is within this peak, then we know we've prepared a state which looks like this, up, up, down, plus down, down, up. That's the eigenstate of the measurement operator, given that we measured this amplitude for the quadrature.
That happens a little more than
one quarter of the time.
One quarter of the time.
Yeah, and it actually scales like it's 2^-n+1.
So you're getting a good fraction of the
yeah.
Points. It's
yeah.
Not like a.
It's not painful.
Down the conversion of answers yeah. Or something like that. Like,
correct. Okay. Yeah. So the full protocol is that you start in the ground state, you do pi on 2 rotations on each qubit, you do your dispersive measurement with this ratio. You can arrange for this ratio to be exactly this because we have these flux lines that we can individually tune the three qubits to tweak these three chi's to be in just the right ratio. And then we post-select for the result that we're in this peak, which we get with probability 1/4, and then we call this a pre-GHD state, which obviously we can just, by just doing a pi rotation on the third qubit, we can convert into a GHD state. And so the scaling of this, if we were to do this with n qubits, we would now need to distinguish 2n-1 peaks, and we would have a acceptance probability that would scale like 2^-1 n. Now that was all kind of idealized, assuming that the qubits don't decay and nothing bad happens. That's not really, really true. There's going to be clearly an optimal measurement time. If we don't measure for very long and we don't do much averaging, these peaks are not very distinguishable. So the red is sort of the theoretical nice answer if there was no decay, and the blue histogram shows results of four simulations, including qubit decay. And we see if you don't average for very long, then the two agree pretty well, but on the other hand, we can't distinguish the states. If we average for longer, then the peaks start to separate, but now you see that this one that should have been the one representing up, 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 the weight's shifted out of that into the one representing down, down, down. There's generally a decay to the left of the weight moves to the left, showing that during this measurement time, some of the qubits decay. And so there's obviously going to be some trade-off. There's going to be some optimal measurement time where you can be more distinguish the states better without there being too much decay.
Can you just measure that shift and then correct for it?
Well, you want to select the guys that were supposed to be in this peak. Right? So you're trying to make an ensemble of states post-selected on that they were the ones that were in the state represented by this peak. In here, there are guys that are supposed to be in here that are real pre-GHG states. And there are also guys in here that started out as some other states and then decayed into here and don't have the coherence. And so there'll be some up, up, down, minus, down, down, up in there if you wait to come on.
And then how are you selecting things? Are you just blocking out some area and saying, anytime my result comes out in there, I'm going to say,
I'll come to that. So we can actually. The simulations, what they give us is for each run of the experiment, virtual simulated run of the experiment, we get an integrated Homodyne signal on the x-axis, and I'm plotting on the y-axis the expectation of the Merman operator, which I'll come back to in the last part of the talk. But for now, what you need to know is that it's a number that would ideally for pure GHC state would reach 4. And in terms of when you want to relate this to a Bell test, this should always be less than 2. And so if you can prepare states with the expectation of this Merman operator being greater than 2, then you're doing well. And you see that if we select, I think this answers your question, say a window within some range on the x-axis here, will accept all the points that fall within that red rectangle. And some of them will have expectation of m greater than 2, and some will have expectation less than 2. And so that's an additional optimization we can do. We can, as well as optimizing the measurement time, we can also decide what thresholds we use, and we can then optimize. We can also trade off the fidelity of the state produced versus the probability of acceptance. If we accept only a very narrow range around 0, we'll not accept as many states, but we'll have higher expectation of that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I was just thinking it seems like you might not even want to just use the integrated signal.
Coming up. I'm trying to lead you in that direction. So how do we actually generate these graphs? Well, we have a measurement model. The operator we're measuring is this A, which is the sum of chi's in the ratio 1 to 1 to 2. We get a Homodyne signal J, which is has got a bit which is depends on the cubic state, and then there's noise on top of that, shot noise. What I'm plotting on the x-axis here is this S, this integrated signal, which is just the integral of this J. And the full model includes dissipation. So this is now describing the density matrix rho conditioned on that we saw a particular Homodyne signal J. So there's just the qubit relaxation term, which has two contributions. One is just intrinsic relaxation of the qubit. And one is qubit relaxation via the cavity, what we call Purcell relaxation, which is just that the excitation that we call qubit actually has some cavity character to it as well, so it can decay via the cavity. There's a measurement-induced dephasing term, and then there's the measurement innervation, which tells us basically how much did the signal that we got out, including this standard C term, which is the fluctuating part, how much does that surprise us? How much does that cause us to update our measurements? And you can put all this together. This is all basically the fact that we were able to eliminate the cavity degree of freedom and describe this as just a master equation for the qubits alone is because we're operating in this regime where the cavity line width is large compared to the chi's. This is all the technology that Hutchison and co-workers developed, and we're just extending this to 3 qubits. One difference between what we're doing and what they did was we've kind of just incorporated this Purcell term straight into on the same footing as the 1 qubit intrinsic decay. In the Hutchison work, they actually kept there's cross terms the individual qubits can interfere with each other as they decay via the cavity. But we've assumed that we're operating. You can arrange the detunings to be such that those cross terms are small. But in the Hutchison work, they were able to actually find an interference between these, which means that the Fresnel rate basically cancels for the Bell state, and so there's no Fresnel decay for the Bell state. That was very advantageous for them. We weren't able to use that, so that's one difference. So we do these simulations, and basically each point on this plot is now one of these is the result of one of these conditional evolutions. So we generate a whole measurement trace, a whole homodyne signal versus time, and we collapse that down onto, you know, we say what's the integrated signal on the x-axis, and on the y-axis we say what's the expectation of the Merman operator at the final time. So we get the individual points, and by selecting on the integrated signal, we basically select out this red rectangle. And we see, okay, it includes a large density of states that have got quite high Merman, but some that have also got quite low Merman. But wouldn't it be nice to, instead of doing our selection on the red block, to do our selection instead on the pink block? So instead, just directly accept the guys which have high expectation of the Merman operator. And I think this comes to exactly what you're saying, that, well, actually, we can do this. If we know the full measurement trace, then we can just run the simulation and just find out exactly, given a particular measurement trace, what is the Merman operator. And so what do a couple of typical traces look like? So if I take two traces, one which has both of which have an interface signal close to zero, but one has very low n and one has very high n, what might they look like? So here's one with very high n. If you see, it's basically fluctuating around. It's I'm plotting the homodyne signal versus time here. It fluctuates around very close to the peak it should be in, and you say, okay, that looks like it was really the state I was hoping for. If you look at this guy, it fluctuates around for a while, like it was in this peak, and then at some time around here, we can say, well, okay, probably the third qubit decayed, and it was in that state, and then at the end of the simulation, it's now in this state. And so, because it did so kind of halfway through the simulation, the average trace is zero, but actually we can infer that what really happened was it started here, and then it decayed to here. We can do this is for a very high signal-to-noise ratio, but the computer code can do this optimally for any signal-to-noise ratio, even when these traces look much too noisy for you to pick anything out by eye. And basically what it's doing is kind of a Bayesian estimation of the system state, given all the information you have, given the full measurement record. And so this shows that there's really a lot more information in the measurement trace than just the mean, and you should really use all of that information. If you, for different signal-to-noise ratios, the signal-to-noise ratio of 2 is in black, the solid line is using the nonlinear filter, and the dotted line is using just this threshold filter. We see that, okay, if 2 is the important number, we can cross it by setting the acceptance probability low enough using the nonlinear filter, but we can't get anywhere close if we don't. And if we're a little bit optimistic and go to the signal-to-noise ratio of 3, then it's very easy using the nonlinear filter, and basically it's still impossible using the average integrated signal. And you'd have to go to much higher signal-to-noise ratios, around 10, before the simple integrated signal would work for you. So the take-home message of this is that, so there's a lot more information in the measurement trace than just the mean. Using the nonlinear filter, we should be able to, using demonstrated signal-to-noise ratios today, generate GHC states with the expectation of the Merman operator greater than 2. There's a couple of assumptions going into this. One of them is that we actually know this measurement trace on a sufficiently fine granularity in time. And another is that we actually know the system parameters, the decay rates, because they go into the simulation. But we haven't done a lot of investigation of this, but it doesn't seem like you need to know them you know, terribly, terribly well. It doesn't seem like that's going to stop this scheme from working. So good, we can prepare JFC states. How can we convince people that we've done so? This is this is a sort of a general problem that you'd like to convince people that you've detected the you produce an entangled state. Well, for JFC, the standard thing you'd like to quote is this Nermin operator, which for 3 qubits is in this form. It's basically, it's got four parities in it. So there's a sigma x, sigma y, sigma y, sigma y, sigma y, and y, y, x. And the GAC state is a simultaneous eigenstate of all four of these, with eigenvalue 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. And so if you could measure each of these parities one after each other using a QND measurement, you could directly measure M. That would be great. We certainly don't expect to be able to do that. But even if we could only measure just one of the, if we could measure any parity, for example, sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, we could use single qubit rotations to rotate these operators into sigma x's and sigma y's in order to measure m. And the fact that we're non-QND doesn't stop us from measuring the expectation of m. It just stops us from measuring m in a single shot. So how would we go about measuring these parities? So we can do a very similar thing to what we did for the preparation by measurement, except adjusting the shifts now. Instead of the shifts being 1 to 1 to 2, now the shifts are 1 to 1 to 1. And then we can have 4 peaks with parity minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1. And so that's nice. We only have to distinguish. Instead of, if you wanted to completely characterize the states of the qubits, we would use the end measurements. But if we only want to measure the parity, we only need to we only need 10 plus 1, so that's an improvement. As before, this is a simplified picture. There's also decay, and so we're going to have false positives and false negatives. And if you really want to convince people that we understand what our measurement is doing, you probably have to detect some other thing. Why is that? Why is that important? I mean, why wasn't that a problem for the preparation? For the preparation, it's not really important what we're measuring. Kind of, the proof is in the pudding. We post-select for the ensemble that we're trying to create, and then we look at it. And if that ensemble is entangled or has the properties we want, then we're done. We don't have to convince people that our measurement was measuring anything in particular. But for verifying the state, we certainly do have to convince people that the measurement is really measuring the sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, and not something else. And so we've come up with a dirty trick for doing this. It's a very simple trick, but nobody seems to be using it much. And the basic idea is that this decay into the state, which I'm going to label as double arrow up, which really represents the state of all qubits being up, is negligible. We operate at low temperature, as I said before. There's basically no rate to excite the qubits on these decay. And so decay into this state is negligible. And so the effects of the operation, the POBN measurement for is the signal in the rightmost peak, can be arranged to be some efficiency times projection onto this up state. And everything else. And if we set this threshold far enough to the right, so that really there's no tail from these three peaks, and we're only picking up this fourth peak, then that's a good approximation. That's kind of the key idea. Does everybody sort of understand what I'm saying there? Now this alpha is kind of then like a detection efficiency in quantum optics, you know, a false negative rate. But we've eliminated the false positives by this trick. And then we can use single qubit rotations to flip all the spins one at a time. And we do all 8 combinations of flipping qubits. We can construct exactly the sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, the parity operator we're looking for, times this efficiency factor. And then we give additional rotations on top of that, another four sets of rotations times these eight rotations, so 32 different measurements. And finally, we get something which is going to be this efficiency factor alpha times the Merman operator. And so instead of having to measure lots of, calibrate our detection in a complicated way with nonlinear minimizations and all the kinds of things that people do generally when they're doing detected tomography, we just have to estimate this one parameter alpha. And that's great, that's a lot simpler and probably a lot easier to convince people that we've done it right, that we did something else. Alternatively, if we don't calibrate out this alpha, we can observe that this alpha is strictly between 0 and 1. And so if we don't calibrate out this alpha and we just get this f, which is alpha times m, then we get a lower bound on. Right? So just to sort of show how this might work, as we shift the threshold around, we can trade off between picking up a tail from this blue peak into this third peak into the fourth peak versus the cutting out too much of the fourth peak and getting a fourth negative rate. And so if we have a sufficiently good signal to noise ratio, we can arrange so that we're somewhere out here and the false positive rate is basically zero, but the false negative rate is greater than 0.5, less than 0.5 and we're able to violate a Bell test. Well, I'll come to that. So this up-up-up trick is very similar to an idea that was actually presented by Kaufman and Korotkov for the purpose of phase qubits. They were the readout scheme for phase qubits is rather different from the dispersive readout that we use, but it has a similar property. What they do is they operate in a regime where they have several states that can, several levels within this potential. So the computational states of 0 and 1. And then when they want to read out, they kind of reduce the barrier height. They increase the current through the circuit. And they're in such that if you're in the 1 state, you have a very good chance of tunneling out. And that's very easily measured because that's a very violent, very macroscopic change of the circuit state. Whereas if you're in the 0 state, not much happens. So that gives them really high fidelity 1 qubit readout. But it gets complicated when you have, say, 3 of these qubits in the same circuit, because now you adjust this one to try and tunnel out. And if he does tunnel out, as I said, it's a very violent thing. There's dissipation, there's a macroscopic change in the circuit. There's a very good chance he'll either kick this one out, even though he was supposed to be in the ground state and not fall out. Or if he was in the excited state, maybe it'll kick him down into the ground state. And so you can't really trust any of the outcomes where any tunneling happened. The only outcome you can trust is the one where you lifted lowered the barrier for all 3 of these qubits and nothing tunneled out. And so instead of it being a trick for them, it's a 0-0-0 trick. It's the same kind of idea. So how does all of this relate to doing a Bell test? Well, it's definitely not a Bell test in the usual sense. There's no way you're going to have the three participants in the test being space-like separated from each other, given the constraints of the dilution refrigerator. They all have to be within 7 millimeters of each other. Plus, even if that wasn't a problem, the dispersive readout is an inherently non-local process. You have to have a photon bounce around a few times within the cavity, even to talk about there being a resonance frequency for the cavity. And so we're not doing a Bell test. But let's try and do something that's kind of as hard as doing a Bell test. Why would we want to do this? Well, maybe just to sort of show how macho we are and that we have a serious quantum information platform that people should take seriously. More pragmatically, maybe by doing something that can be described in terms of a Bell test, maybe that's going to be a more convincing argument to convince people that we've produced the state we say we have, rather than saying, well, we do detected tomography, state tomography, we're doing nonlinear minimizations and so on. Here's something that looks like a Bell test. We really think we have an entangled state. So now I feel the irony of standing up in front of the Quantum Foundation's group at Perimeter Institute and saying, what's it, having a slight feigning to tell you what is a Bell test, but I think I should just give my interpretation, and so I can distinguish what a Bell test would be from what we're actually doing. So the idea is we have participants, Alice and Bob, I guess in the Alice and Bob rooms, and I guess Carol gets to be in the Lazaridis room or something like this. And they're supposed to have their operators local to them in their own room. And for a projective measurement, they have different settings for their devices depending on which measurement they want to do. For us, that means they rotate their qubits in different directions before measuring them. And the locality for a projective measurement implies that the operators that represent these measurements should commute with each other. And that means that if you do a joint measurement using settings IJK for the Alice, Bob, and Carol, then that measurement should factorize in the form A, B, C. So there's an operator that lives in Alice's class in the orbit space, an operator that lives in Bob's class in the public space, and an operator that lives in Carol's class in the public space. So these guys are in their own rooms with their local operators. They do their measurements, they choose settings, and they record, write down the outcomes. At the end of the protocol, they get together. They compare notes. They say, okay, I measured on X and I got plus one. What did you get? And they write down a big list of the results. And they get together and they decide, could any classical theory reasonably describe those results? That's necessarily going to be a probabilistic statement. What you're actually going to say is quantum mechanics is much, much more plausible for classical mechanics given these results. You could always say, well, the classical theory that I'm going to propose is that you get a random result for any measurements. And it just so happens that you get the results you saw. That would be a valid classical theory, but it would be quite unlikely to produce the... It's like saying that you saw 100... You tossed the coin 100 times and you got heads 100 times. You could have a classical theory that says, well, there's a 50-50 chance. And you just got lucky and saw 100 heads. But that seems a bit less likely than the theory that actually I had a two-headed coin. Now, there's the important point is there's no requirement to look at all of the possible results. We can, if we want to, restrict ourselves to showing that if classical physics is unable to explain the subset of the results where the outcome is up, 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 then that's enough to have performed a Bell test. So that's the key. Now, with POBMs, it gets a little bit more complicated. The non-signaling is the key thing. Certainly, for the measurements to be considered local, there should be non-signaling. Alice, Bob, and Carol should not be able to send messages to each other just by their choice of measurements directions. Within the QM quantum mechanical framework, non-signaling is enough to make the it's equivalent to locality, as was shown by Deeks in 2002. So what we want to do is at least make sure that our measurement doesn't obviously signal. In principle, we're not space-like separated. There's no special relativity argument saying that there must be non-signaling. But let's check and make sure that our measurement doesn't seem to signal, doesn't appear to signal. Because if there's obvious ways to signal, then we've already failed, and this is definitely not a Bell test. So this is kind of a minimal requirement. And in the language of POBMs, that means that the operator, the measurement, joint measurements FIJK now gets replaced by measurement effects. So there's an extra set of effects. And it was shown by Bush and Singh in 1998 that the non-signaling requirement for POBMs is that the effects should factorize. And it turns out that, well, the up-up-up effect that we're considering is exactly of this form, factorized in this way. So as long as we have vanishing false positive rate, and so long as our one qubit rotations are really one qubit rotations and don't do anything between the qubits, then we have a measurement that doesn't signal. And so that's in some sense as hard as doing a Bell test. So we're not going to allow ourselves to calibrate out the false negatives, because that would be allowing the detection loophole. And if we put all this together and we say, what is the signal to noise ratio that we need to have to do a bell test, this so-called bell test this way, then the signal to noise ratio has to be quite a lot larger than anything that's been demonstrated experimentally, around 20. So there's going to need to be some major technological improvements before that's possible. But anyway, just to sort of sum all of this up, preparation by measurement has some advantages for circuit QED. It has different scaling properties to how producing states by using gates, for example. Of course, lots of effort is going into improving two-qubit gates, and two-qubit gates are definitely going to improve in the future. And it's not clear under what circumstances it's best to use preparation by measurement versus gates. It depends on how much do you care about your production rate, your probability of success, and so on. But it has different properties, so maybe it's interesting. Preparation of 3-qubit states in this way is possible today. We've come up with a measurement operator which has rather simple detector tomography. It's very easy to characterize, which we like. But doing a bell-like test, something which is as hard as a bell test, is still a difficult problem in this sense. If you want to read more about that, that's New Journal of Physics. Thanks very much.
I think we can see why you won the award. Are there some questions?
I missed this point about with bell tests where you can take a subset of the data and would have to apply as well. Like I'm just imagining if I had two classically random variables, that's all classical. But if I just picked out all the anti-correlated pairs out of that and then checked against
some
quality, I'm sure I can fire
it one. So let's say I had two. My classical theory is that I have two fair coins, and I toss them and I write down. What do I get? So sometimes I get some number of occasions where I get heads-heads, sometimes I get heads-tails, some number where I get tails-tails, sometimes where I get heads-tails. All four possibilities. Let's say I only look at the ratio of times that I got both heads to anything else. So even if maybe that means I'm insensitive, if I did this protocol 100 times and I got heads 100 times, I would say that was suspicious. If I did that protocol 100 times and I got tails, I could also say that was suspicious. But let's say I only look at the heads row, and I say, is the number of times I got heads plausible given my classical theory? I'm explaining this rather badly.
It sounds like that doesn't sound like a subset of the data, because you're always comparing some of the data as a probability compared to the total amount. You're still considering the whole data set, right? And you're just looking at a frequency of one particular.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I said that slightly wrongly. Yeah.
Okay. If that's what you mean, then
that's what I mean. I don't mean. We don't have to look at the all the cases where there was up, down. It's the ratio of up to everything else. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay. So the measurement operator you constructed has like four different varieties, you said?
Sorry.
The measurement operator that you built has like four different correlations. But I wonder why it's not just three instead of four?
You're talking about...
So I mean, the GHC state should be uniquely defined by three parities, I guess. So it's probably that one of them is unnecessary.
The idea is that if you would calculate the classical equivalent to this, this would classically, if you would calculate the correlation xxxxx minus the correlation xyy and so on, That would at most be two, classically. But quantum mechanically, it can be four. And so it's
okay.
You're just taking the genes and say it's stabilized by
three operators, right? So one of them seems dependent. I wonder if there is something more in the.
Well, if you take the product of any three, you get the four.
Yeah. Right? So when do you have to measure the four?
The idea of this is to distinguish quantum mechanics from
yeah, I mean, if you're going to assume it's quantum mechanical,
yeah.
Then you never needed to do the test in the first place.
Yeah. That's basically it.
Well, that actually is a lead-in for my question.
Sure.
It's not really a question, it's a comment. Stephen Bennick gave us a talk here about a year ago on what he was doing with Jeff Kimball to give some test for whether they were staying independent in some of their experiments. And I'm having a hard time conjuring up the details of what he told us. But I remember that it went something along these lines. And he was relying on some work from Jos Uffink and Michael Sievink. And that is, people often say that if you're trying to generate a quantum state, an entangled quantum state, let's say of two qubits, and you would like to give some confirmation that you have an entangled state there. And one quick test is to go out and measure a Bell inequality and see whether, let's say, the CHSH inequality, and see whether the CHSH quantity is larger than 2. You don't have to get all the way to 2 root 2.
Yeah.
But as long as it's larger than 2, then you say, I know I've got some entanglement there. But what Uffink and Sievink, and I guess Van Enck and Kimball point out is that really that's a test that compares quantum mechanics to a local realistic model. If you say, I believe quantum mechanics, I'm not testing it against the local realistic model. What I'm testing is whether I've generated an entangled quantum state within quantum mechanics versus not generating an entangled quantum state. You can get correlations in the CHSH quantity that are smaller than 2. So not outside of the classical bound, smaller than 2, but still indicate that it had to be an entangled quantum state rather than an unentangled quantum state that was generated. Is this correct?
Anybody remember this?
And so Stephen sort of presented it as a kind of paradox. Most people would say, no, that can't be right. But actually, there's a gap. What you can do with unentangled, the correlations you can get from unentangled quantum states doesn't reach the two level of CHSH. Then you need entangled quantum states to generate from whatever that other number is up to 2.
Mm-hmm.
You can still give a locally realistic model for that, but you can't get it from an unentangled quantum state. So it just strikes me that maybe some thinking like that could be used here rather than measuring the full Merman operator, rather than expecting of your Merman operator that it has to be above the classical bound.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe by thinking about it more along the lines of Uffink and Company, you can say, even though we've got a small number, we do have an impact.
I mean, I think sort of the direction people are going, and I think Jerry will also talk about this at IQC next week, is rather than trying to do a Bell test, we just try and measure an entanglement witness. And it's very related. You know, the Merman operator is a particular entanglement witness, as is the CHSH operator. But there are a large number of other witnesses that don't work as for doing Bell tests, but still give you confidence that you have an entangled state.
That's certainly related. I just remembered in Benek's talk, if I understood it correctly, was actually using the CHSH operator.
Okay.
As an entanglement witness, but the
the expectations that you need if you're using it as an entanglement witness, not as a test of a local realist theory, is a different number.
Okay. I mean, certainly for us, the difference would be if we believe quantum mechanics and we believe our model, we can divide through by alpha this efficiency factor.
Yeah.
And then it's a lot less stringent, you know. As long as that alpha is non-zero, we can estimate the entanglement.
Lev, do you have the plot of the CHSH inequality?
I might.
No, I mean the recent experiment.
Yeah.
Because this explains exactly what Chris was talking
yeah.
about.
Oh, really?
We even bound.
So I said something sensible.
We even bound what's.
I
bound what's allowed with for the given operators we choose if we had quantum mechanics.
This one you want?
Yeah. So for those set of operators, quantum mechanics has entanglement of anything above root 2. But a local hidden variable theory can go up to 2.
There must be some assumption then on the Hilbert space associated with this.
It's the commutator relationship between X and Z.
Because obviously you can get some of the classical model, and that classical model could be instantiated by a sufficient number of qubits.
Yeah, but you won't have the commutators that are generated by the application of X and Z. So if you're assuming that quantum mechanics is described and we're choosing these orthogonal operators
mm-hmm.
that have all the properties of quantum mechanics,
right.
those commutators are going to then set a limit that this witness has to be above. But if you allow them to be arbitrary so they're not commuting in the way they do,
mm-hmm.
then you'll get through.
Okay.
Any final questions? Well, let's thank Lev again for an excellent talk. And wish him well in his new career as a professional physicist.